Aye, Meeting. This is the regular Sunday open meeting of the Charter Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's open with a moment of silent meditation, followed by the Serenity Prayer. Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Hi, everybody. My name is Laura Jones, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. This is a preamble to Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, nor does it wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I want to welcome everyone here tonight, especially those that this might be your first meeting. You're very, very special people to us, and we're very glad to have you here. As Joe said, please do not smoke. We just cannot handle it with this many people in this gym. And tonight, I have asked R.O. if he would read how it works.
My name is R.O. Sutton, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'm delighted to be here today and on this very special occasion where some birthdays are being celebrated, one of which is Dr. Conway Yates. This is where it all began for me, and this program does work. I'm standing here today to testify that it does work. And here's how it works, as recorded in the fifth chapter of the big book entitled Alcoholics Anonymous. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually, men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like today. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all of the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember, we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested to the program of recovery. One, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage own life. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he was sought.
Thank you, R.O. And I've asked Joanne if he would read the 12 traditions.
Thank you, Laura. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic named Joe Nelson.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, everybody. I, like R.O., Emma, it all began for me here, and I consider it a privilege to take part in this meeting today. These are our 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God. He may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Would some of our charter group gentlemen start the collection baskets, please? We have a very special speaker this afternoon, and I am very happy to be able to introduce him, although I don't think he needs any introduction. Father Joe, I think, is well known to most of us here in this room, and I'm not going to take up any of his time because I want to hear what he has to say. So, Father Joe M.,
seeing those young folks up in that scaffolding back there puts me in mind of a marvelous story of a young lad who came up to visit the States from Mexico. And when he got back home to his little country village, they asked him if he enjoyed his visit to the States. And he said, "See, how were the people?" He said, "They were wonderful." He said, "One afternoon they took me to a ball game, and the stadium was so full that someone suggested I climb up to the top of the flagpole. So I did, and as soon as I got up there and got seated, the flag came up behind me." And he said, 50,000 people all stood up. They turned and looked at me and sang, "Jose, can you see?" Anyway. Now, once and for all, I happen to be an alcoholic. Now, if any of you have seen any of those films and were not able to figure that out, you still need some attention, and maybe you're in the right place to stay to get it. This obviously is an extremely special occasion, and I just kind of thought I'd do a little something different this afternoon. We alcoholics are almost incomprehensible to other people. I have a sister, Frances, who is worried about our baby sister, Dorothy, who is dying of the disease. And she will look at her, and there are a couple of friends of hers. One's a nurse, one's the wife of a commercial airline pilot. And Frances has heard me speak, you know, the old chalk talk, supposedly an explanation of it. She's been to some AA banquets and meetings and so on, and she'll still say things like, "Well, this friend of hers, Carmen, knows that she's going to get so sick. Why does she drink that way?" The non-alcoholic will almost never really comprehend what compulsion is all about. And that's why I think that of equal importance to scientific lectures is humor. I really believe that humor teaches as much about this disease as anything else can teach. Isn't it strange that this is the only disease that we joke about? It's a terminal illness. If the alcoholic does not stop drinking, the drinking will stop him. And yet we joke about it, and that's accepted. We would be appalled if someone were to tell a joke about cancer. It's almost inconceivable. And yet jokes about alcoholics are taken for granted. And yet, I believe that it is only fitting that we should be able to retrieve something of the comic from the previously tragic. Some of the funniest stories I've ever heard involve alcoholism. For example, compulsion. An alcoholic walked into a bar And over the bartender's head, he saw a sign that said, "All you can drink, $1. All you can drink, $1. He said, "I'll have $2 worth." We are built that way. He had a cousin who was walking along the beach. A bottle came in, and it had no note in it, but there was kind of a mist inside. And when he uncorked it, the mist became a genie. And the genie said, "Thank you for my freedom. You have 3 wishes." And the alcoholic looked at the bottle, which was empty, and he thought, "Well, I'll test this genie." He said, "I'd like to see that thing perpetually, perpetually filled." Genie said, "Done." And it was. And he drank, and it was filled. And he drank, and it was filled. No matter how many drinks he took, it was full. He's in hog heaven. For all eternity, he has a never-ending source of supply. Well, of course, the genie wanted to be on his way. He said, "What are your other 2 wishes?" He said, "I'll have 2 more of these." Yeah, it's an amazing thing. The man who saved my life used to say, AA is the greatest university on earth. It's where a priest learns from plumber how to live, and he was right. And we do learn some wonderful truths about living in AA. For example, you don't need brains to get well. You need desire. But in the learning process, we have to listen to each other, and so we come to these meetings. And I'll never forget, as years have gone by, listening to people say absolutely brilliant things. I mean, God, they're all geniuses. Until you find out they're just repeating something they heard from somebody else. But we very glibly say things as though we had invented them. I'll never forget, never. The first time I heard a fellow, it was in my home group, right after I got back from the guest house. He said, "I got sick and tired of being sick and tired." I thought that was a stroke of absolute genius. I found I've been around for years. And then a fellow came down. We used to have an intergroup. It was a Sunday night thing in the early days. I'm speaking not of the real early days, but my early days in Baltimore, when a lot of the groups could come to a Sunday night meeting, and you got to know everyone in the city, really. Of course, it's grown since, obviously. But I'll never forget, a fellow came down from Philadelphia, and he said, "Through alcoholism, I lost everything." He said, "Everything busted up, my family, my marriage, jobs, and so on." And he said, "My wife and I got divorced," but he said, "it was a rather friendly settlement involved." He said, "We split everything right down the middle, 50-50, even the house. She got the inside, I got the outside." I thought that was one of the funniest things I ever heard in my life. It'd been around for years. But there was another story that I had occasion to recall rather recently. I had heard it some 20 years ago, and it just kind of went by the wayside. But the marvelous thing, the alcoholic's reactions and the quickness of his mind in a kind of a perverted way. Somebody once said, "We alcoholics are a cut above average intellectually." I always say there's a damn many of us have got to be a brain someplace, but, we're so smart, what brought us here? Anyways, the reaction of the alcoholic to things very often can be fairly humorous. There was a fellow who bought a terribly expensive grandfather clock in Germany, brought it back to England, and he took it to the local clockmaker to have it repaired and brought into working order, and it cost him another fortune. And he went down one afternoon to pick it up, and of course there was no way of getting it to his cottage except to carry it. So they put this huge grandfather clock on his back, and he's making his way through the village till he gets right opposite the pub. And this old drunk came flying out, plowed into him, knocked the clock dead. Well, of course, the clock was shattered. He was furious. He said, "Why don't you watch where you're going?" The drunk says, "Why in the hell don't you wear a wristwatch like everybody else?" I have to pass this one on to you because I heard it down here in Atlanta 1 year ago at the last CCAD. I was told by a Delta pilot friend of mine. He said, "You can use them," and I have since. Now, I'm sure a lot of you here like to fish, and this is a fisherman's story. This group of men, there was a game warden, a real estate agent, a couple of farmers, hardware store owner, five or six of them. They fished together. And they were standing at the banks of their favorite river, griping about the fact that the fishing was not good that particular year. And one of their buddies came rowing up in a rowboat filled with fish. So as they're helping him unload the thing, they say, "Where did you get these?" He said, "Around the corner here at Jackson's Cove." They said, "We fished there. There's no fish in there to speak of." He said, "You fellas just don't know how to fish." They said, "All right, wise guy, you show us." So when the last fish was out of the boat, they all jumped in. He rowed around, dropped anchor. Well, they were expecting to see some brand new rod or a sophisticated lure. No such thing. He lit a cigar. And when the cigar got a good red-hot end on, he reached under the rowing bench, took out a stick of dynamite. And he lit it, and he let it burn for a while, and he dropped it in the water. Of course, when that thing exploded, a couple of hundred dead fish came up. And he's scooping them into the boat, and they're killing him. Killing him. Your grandchildren should be ashamed of your name. No one should speak to you. No sportsman. How can you call yourself a sportsman? They're really creaming it. He's saying nothing, pulling the fish in, and the game warden is absolutely furious. He said, "You will go to jail." Now, he said, "I'll see that you go to jail." And he said, "You won't get another fishing license for 10 years around here." With that, he got the last fish in. Didn't say a word. Reached under the rowing bench, took out another stick of dynamite. He lit it, let it burn about halfway down, and handed it to the game warden. He said, "You going to fish or talk?" Well, that is. Now, in the Baltimore area, at least in the old days, whatever you did, you had that so-called qualified. Now, you know, I think the statement that I drank too much too often would be enough. But some of the peculiarities that distinguish... Hey, by the way, there are norms for normal drinking. And there are normal drinkers. You know, I've said that before. You know, some of the reaction of part of AA's is, "Ho, ho, ho, what's a normal drinker? I never met one." And I always say, "Ho, ho, ho, look who you used to drink with. No wonder you never met one." But there are normal drinkers. And if a person drinks the way normal people drink, normally he has no trouble. My definition of the alcoholic is one who doesn't drink normally. And one who doesn't drink normally usually winds up with his drinking causing problems. You know, you don't need a PhD to grab alcoholism. Hey, by the way, if a kid knows what an alcoholic is, you ought to be able to. Isn't it indicative of the damage done to the reasoning processes whereby an alcoholic comes into treatment and cannot see what his kids can see, that he's having trouble with alcohol? I'll never forget one time a friend of mine said that a patient came in to see him. He said, "Now, I've looked at your movies and listened to your lectures and attended all your groups and so on." He said, "Now, let me tell you something. I haven't lost anything that all these people are talking about, so I don't know what they're talking about." He said, "I still have my family, my wife, my cars, my job, a good job. I got money in the bank." And he went on for about an hour trying to convince the fellow that he doesn't belong there. When it was, I had never heard this before, never heard it used. And when a man had finished, this therapist looked at him and he said, "Now, you have just told me and we have just discussed all the things that alcohol has not done to you. So let's not talk about them. Let's talk about what it has done to you." My own kindergarten process of diagnosing alcoholism is simplicity itself. You look at the behavior you're concerned about and you answer this question: do normal drinkers do this? And if your answer is no, you're talking about abnormal drinking. There's a whole lot of stuff, a whole lot more scientific. There's a whole lot of physical examinations that turn up things that show the damages of alcoholic drinking. But I still think that's about as accurate as you can get. Austin Ripley, my sponsor, used to say, "Look at the major problems of your life. Has the bottle been prominently in the picture before, during, or after? If your answer is yes, sign up." Did you ever lie about your drinking? Yes or no? Just look at the right. Yes or no? If your answer is yes once, you are probably an alcoholic. Twice, you are. You are. I have no doubt of that in my mind. Answer the question: do normal drinkers lie about their drinking? Answer: they have absolutely no reason to. Did you ever hide a bottle? Did you ever hide one from yourself? Did you ever find one after you've been in AA 17 years? Now, I'll tell you, if you've ever had this problem, you definitely are in the right place. Many of us, with all of our brilliant background and education and degrees and everything else, were absolutely stumped. Absolutely stumped with this impossible, horrible, earth-shattering problem when we were drinking. How to get rid of empty bottles. A three-year-old would say, throw them out. That's much too much for us. First of all, because it is too simple. How many of you found that the turning point in your recovery was when you grasped the simplest statement of all? If you don't take a drink, you can't get drunk. The answer to your problem is don't take a drink. And God, I don't want to hear that. Tell me anything but that. Don't tell him not to drink. But, you know, a moron can grasp the fact that if you don't take a drink, you can't get... This is a fact, and I've known it to happen in a minimum of two cases, and I know there are more. I know of a fellow in the Baltimore area, came to AA. He knew in his guts that you cannot live without drinking. He just instinct told him that. He was a pure alcoholic. How can one live without drinking? Well, of course, the trouble came into his life, and there was a shotgun at his head, and he went to AA, and he was there to find out. He went to three or four meetings. He said, they haven't let it out yet, but he said, I know these people are drinking. If they say they're alcoholics, they've got to be drinking, but they've got a secret somewhere. I know that if I hang around long enough, somebody's going to let it out. And one night, somebody did. It's the first drink that gets you drunk. Boy, he sat there in that meeting and quivered until the Our Father was over with. He shot out of that, I'm not making this up, I mean it sounds wacky, but this is true. He shot out of the meeting, went to the nearest bar, ordered a double shot of bourbon, and let it set. He said, now give me another one. And he drank about nine of them, fell off the bar stool and said, the sons of bitches told me it was the first one and I didn't drink it. That's true. We're a cut above average, all right. Somebody once said that love is better the second time around, and it's true. You non-alcoholics in this room, you really don't know what sobriety is. You've never lost it. Somebody once said you really appreciate water after the well runs dry. I remember at home one time, it was just last year, a storm cut off the electricity in our little settlement there, and we were 30 hours without it. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. And boy, do you appreciate it when it comes back on? For at least 4 or 5 minutes, anyway. And sobriety. Oh, intellectually, of course you know. Of course you know. Intellectually, I know what gambling is about. I understand it up here, but not down here. And I'm an alcoholic. I have an addiction. But I know this, that when one has been incapable of loving, we burn to love and be loved. And it comes out sentimental at best and perverted at worst. And then we are freed, we are liberated from this addiction that prevents our ability to love, and we've got it back. And God, we want to double and triple everything. We want to go to the well of sobriety and drink it dry. We want to gulp all day. Those who really latch onto the program can't wait until the next meeting. We want tomorrow yesterday. We're all familiar with that. We hear a man or a woman speak at an AA meeting. They have, let's say, 12, 15, 27 years of sobriety. And you're just burning inside. God, will I ever get to that stage? Will I ever get there? Will I ever get there? And AA keeps telling us, easy does it. Come on, easy does it. And as the I gets back over the E, when intellect begins to predominate over our feelings again, our minds tell us everything on earth is governed by law. Everything. When the astronauts, you know, were this close to it, they came down yesterday. When those fellows went into space, absolutely catapulted by a burst of power that the human mind finds almost incomprehensible. They knew that everything was following laws that had been set for centuries. They had discovered them. They knew that things operated in a certain way, and up they went. They knew that when they slept and woke up again, that thing would still be in its orbit. It would still be going at a certain rate of speed. It would still be governed by laws of geometry and physics and so on. There are laws of time. There are moral laws. We know that every single thing is governed by law, even growth. And from first year high school on, we know that a blade of grass will grow up in a day's time. All other things being equal, sunlight, moisture, fertilizer, and so forth. And it begins in this almost frantic pursuit. It begins to dawn on us that there are laws of growth in the spiritual life. I will progress or mature according to certain laws, provided I'm working at it, providing all other things are present, and I still become impatient with progress. And AA, like a loving mother, says, easy does it. Will this marriage ever, ever, ever be patched up? Will the things that have been done and that can never, ever be undone, will there ever be any kind of reconciliation? Will the things that were said be forgiven? Will I ever, ever, ever regain the respect of decent people? How in the name of God can I repay these financial debts that are absolutely unbearable, staggering, and gigantic? We are almost over. It's like a rat in a cage who has given 18 doors to freedom, and he doesn't know which one to take. And AA says, easy does it. And somebody says, how do you do it easy? How? And the marvelous answer comes back, one day at a time, we will grow. And in that day, we will grow one day's growth. There are professional AA retreat goers, 2 and 3 a week, until spirituality grows stale. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the greatest ills of human nature is that it can become bored so easily, and we become too bored with spiritual, non-touchable things. I believe that 2 a year have far greater benefit than 52 a year. And yet somehow I believe that even though a retreat is a time of great grace, many of us somehow have it in us that we honestly believe if I go away for a Friday night, a Saturday, and a Sunday morning, I will automatically mature 3 months in a weekend. No, you won't. No, you won't. Too many of us grab the emotional, some spiritual uplift, some little twang, and feel that we have progressed by months. All other things being equal, I will grow a day's growth in a day's time. What is a day? Well, it's the normal unit of time. It has been subdivided into hours and minutes and seconds. But basically, it's the period of work and rest, night and day, light and darkness, and they follow each other these days every 24 hours. And this is what we have to work in and rest in. And the work cannot be frantic. I must take each day as it comes and live it. But these terms are so glib. We talk, hey, see you again, day at a time, doing it. How you doing? Oh, fine, day at a time. And they, yeah, day at a time, we'll get there. Yeah, one day at a time, guys bouncing off the walls, you know, day at a time. Now, what does it mean? What does it mean? I remember one time, I normally hate to attend banquets because they always get somebody from the ranks of us clergy to give an invocation. God, do we invoke. And instead of bless the food and eat, I can see the dear Lord up there saying the beans are getting cold. I honestly believe that most made-up prayers are recited primarily for human listeners rather than the God to whom they are addressed. I have said elsewhere that the best prayers you ever said were the prayers you said when you were drunk. Don't ever undersell them, by the way. They were the best you ever said. Don't knock them. You see, he answered them. You're here. Because there were no frills on them. The prayer of the drunk is the cry of a soul in pain, and that's what God listens to. It's not just, oh, Lord of heavenly souls. But I'll never forget one invocation. It was done at an AA banquet, and it was so startlingly beautiful that they had it reprinted. In this invocation, the priest who gave it gave his definition of today as a manageable segment of time. Now, before we get into how to use a today, let's forevermore put to rest this absolutely dizzy notion that some say, well, the only important thing in my life is today. Your past is gone. I haven't got a future. Just today. Oh, shut up. That's garbage. Now, I've got a past, and it's bloody important. And I don't get rid of the garbage of my past. I reconcile my guilt about it. That's what step five does. It reconciles guilt. But my past, ladies and gentlemen, is locked in. It's there. I don't get rid of that. The only thing I can do with my past is to commend it to the mercy of God. And if you're like me, a bunch of my past I'm very proud of, and a bunch of it I'm terribly ashamed of. But I can never change it, and it's there. And I don't know about you, but I do have a future, and I'm not being presumptuous. I do have a future. I just don't know how long it is. The only thing that AA teaches, and the only thing that anyone with sense teaches, is you do have a past, and you do have a future, and they're both important. What was just read in the prologue? Our story should disclose in a general way what we used to be like. AA demands that when we speak, we recall our past. It's not gone. It's gone in the sense that I'm not doing it. It is something that has been done, but it is a fact. In fact, my friends, my past explains the me that is standing here. My past is extremely valuable. Because it is a university from which I can learn. My future, I commend to the providence of God, and I place it in His care. The only thing, again, that AA and all other normal, good, solid people try to teach us about the past, the present, the future is, don't live in the past. And don't live in the future, because you'll miss the present, which is what you have to use and to manage. The most important day of my life is this one. This one. And so I am asked to use it well. I am asked to use it well. Why must I do that? We've seen in AA what happens when we don't. Have you ever watched people try to do things without preparation and without guidance? Those of you who don't have sponsors, you're already in trouble. You better get yourself one. Because everybody goes flying off in 1,000 directions trying to accomplish a whole lot, and action without preparation results in failure most of the time. Failure, repeated failure, leads to discouragement. And there's no greater enemy to progress than discouragement. And if there's enough of it, discouragement gives birth to quitting. If I try without using the proper tools, it's like people that I compare getting sober without the steps of AA to trying to drive nails with milk bottles. The bottle will break. Better get a hammer. And if I try to do things that are absolutely essential for progress without preparation, I will fail. And if I fail enough, I'll get discouraged. And if I get discouraged enough, I'll quit. And so AA says, don't live in the past or the future. Take this day and live it intelligently. But the people that talk about, yeah, live it a day at a time, never tell you how. They never tell you how. They never explain it. I cannot control today. I can control or manage some of it. And that's where my growth comes. Ladies and gentlemen, have you ever looked at somebody? You look at a Dr. Hunter, say, 15 years. God, he runs this place. He's helped people get well. I wonder if I could ever do anything like that. We look at people and we envy the structure, the monument that they are. Every single one of us builds his own monument. Every one of us. Hey, by the way, don't kill people for proper, normal preparation for the future. You know, some guy says, well, have you ever heard this in AA? It's one of those glib statements. Well, where are you going, Jim? Well, I'm going downtown, and I have saved my money, and I want to get a World Series ticket. Now, you're projecting. Where are you going? Well, I'm going to the bank. I'm going to put a few bucks in. I have a little daughter I want to prepare for her college education. You're projecting. No, he's not. He's acting normal. If any of you people don't provide for your future, you're screwballs and still need considerable attention. The only thing AA says is, don't live in the future. Well, when I get this job, I'm going to build a house, and then you go and sign a contract. Somebody says, you got the job yet? No. That's projecting. But there are normal preparations for the future. All I'm asked to do is use the present so that I can have a normal, decent future. How do I use each day? As it comes, one at a time. And so, with the help of a sponsor, now let me share this with you from the life of a friend of mine. He got sober at age 25. He had a decent job he was about ready to lose. And he owed money everywhere. He owed it to a couple of doctors, a couple of dentists, and a lot of landlords. And it was overwhelming. He had to work on his marriage. He had to work on his family. He had to work on amends to friends and relatives. He had to work on all these financial debts. You know how he did it? A little bit at a time. He went to everybody that he owed money to. And he said, now look, I happen to be an alcoholic. I'm in AA about 9 months. I think I'm quite sure I'm getting well in the proper way. He said, I owe you $1,700. Now, I cannot pay you this Friday. But what I'll do this Friday is bring you a half dollar, and I'll bring you a half dollar every Friday until you are paid. And he went from one to the other, and he settled it. There's a fellow back home. He's sober in AA many, many years. And I'm not saying this unkindly. It's simply a fact of his life. He's a parasite. He borrows money and never repays it. He only repaid one man who grabbed him by the throat and said, you will repay me. And he did $1 a week, and he discharged his debt. How do I work? This happens to me constantly. Somebody is sober 3 weeks, and he says, how can I get back to my wife? And you know, you're almost handcuffed. There's no glib answer to that. I say, and I always say this, I'm a realist. Too many people break up after sobriety because they find they're two brand new people and they have nothing common to work on anyway. So I never hold up false hope. I just say, I don't know whether you'll ever get back to your wife. Let's hope and pray that you do. But you cannot expect anybody to do anything less than make book on you at this point in your sobriety. You have 18 years of drinking behind you and 3 weeks of sobriety behind you. Austin Ripley used to tell us when we came back from guest house, he said, you can bet that people will be making book on you, but every single day that you stay sober, the odds in your favor increase. And this is what I tell people, how can I ever get my kids back? I say, I don't know. But you will never get them back without sobriety. So you just stay sober. And the only thing that I can promise you is this. If you stay sober day after day, good things will happen. I don't know what they are, But I do know that they will be. And it always happens. Now, how do you live a day at a time? There's a... I live with a family, as many of you know, Tommy and May Abraham. They have one son. He's a bowler, professional bowler. He's having... It's almost like a pitcher's arm now. He's getting some therapy for it, and he can't bowl for a while, and it's killing him. But Alex is a good bowler. Just this past July, he rolled a perfect game in tournament play. And that was one of the highlights of his athletic life. That boy, from about age 14, he's now 24, has bowled 100 games a week. And I've seen him bowl when his hands, this finger and this thumb, were so sore that they were raw. But he kept at it. And he gained what that practice bought. His professionalism. You've heard of Babe Dietrichson's Zaharias? In my opinion, she is the female athlete of this century. She died of cancer. She was not a raving beauty physically. She made her name, I think, in track. And then as she got older, she turned to professional golf, and she was the best. And one day on a golf course, she smacked an absolutely picture drive. She had the grace of a ballet dancer. And she whacked that ball, and it went exactly where she wanted it to. And some man watching her said, "Thank God," he said, "what a beautiful drive. You must have been born with it." She said, "Born with it, hell. I got that drive from hitting 1,000 golf balls every day." We learn to live a day at a time by living a day at a time. Now, how do we do it? Simplicity itself. Some years ago, we had a teacher of the history of philosophy. His name is Father Lyman Fenn. He's retired now. And we used to call him the All-American Boy because he was almost perfect in everything. His classes were the best because they were the best prepared. It was a pleasure to go in and just listen to the geometry of his classes. He had, of course, a brilliant mind, and he was a top-notch athlete. Good skier, good tennis player, handball, excellent diver, perfected it all by working at it. And very rarely could you get Father Fenn off the subject in class. But one day, somebody got talking about the schedule, you know. Fellows that get down toward the end of the year and they have a term paper due and they have to burn the midnight oil. And how many of us as students had to do that? You know, you're cram for an exam. And I know he lived that way, or this way, the way he described, because it's obvious. Failure breeds discouragement, and discouragement breeds quitting. And so many of us quit because we never plan before we execute. Well, I'm going to clean this up in my life. And 3 days later, you know, you're not perfect. And you slide. It's like me trying to lose weight. I'll try something for a few days or even a few months. Then after a while, you get tired of the boredom and the tedium of it, and you slide. Fenn said, "All right, you fellows get up at 20 minutes to 6. You have meditation from 6 to 6:30. Mass for an hour. Breakfast for 20 minutes. And then a brief 15 minutes for a smoke. Then you go to your rooms before first class in the morning." And why can't we do this when we use the time in the morning when we read our 24-hour book? Take a second, take one of those little teeny pads, and write down just two or three things. That's all. "Today I'm going to write a letter home. Today I will apologize to this gal I yelled at work yesterday. And today, after dinner, I will wash the dinner dishes." All right, I mean, that's, you know, something for us. But he would tell these fellows, "Today I will go to the library and spend 20 minutes reading for my term paper. I will prepare philosophy for tomorrow. And I will write a letter home." Now, hold on to your dentures. This is the profound part. He said, after you've done that, after you've written these two or three things down, do them. Just do them. At the end of the day, you can point to it and say, "I've done that." How many of us have ever in AA had the equivalent of, let's say, either in the moral sense, the spiritual sense, the charitable sense, or let's just take financial. I owe $16,000. I do nothing about it, and each day it becomes more and more horrendous and discouraging. Supposing you pay back a dollar a day, at the end of each day you can say, jeepers, I paid back a dollar. And at the end of a year you got 365 of them paid off. Or whatever. Whatever. You never write down more than can be done. Never. Because it will discourage you when you don't do it. Last night, Alex and his wife dropped by the house to leave their baby while they went to visit some in-laws. Gina, the wife, did not exactly have the reputation of being an immaculate housekeeper. She read a book in which AA is referred to. It's written by two sisters. Two blood sisters who were sloppy, sloppy housewives and sloppy housekeepers. You know, they got together and they have a little bitty file, and Gina has done this. She writes down things to do each day, things that have to be done each week, things that have to be done each season, like the closets or whatever. She's about that high off the ground because every day she takes the proper card out and does it. And at the end of the day, something is done. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this may have sounded like twaddle to you. But if you do it, you'd be stunned, absolutely stunned at how good you feel about yourself. And when you look at somebody else and say one day at a time, you can sit down and tell them how it's done. Every today of my life is a tile that goes into the mosaic that you're looking at. Most of us, I think, are normal, good people. And so I imagine the picture of our lives that others have to look at are or should be fairly attractive. The bright colors. A lot of the colors we see in the beginning of fall. There may be some gloomy colors. May even be a gold or two. And I believe that each of us is capable of a touch of greatness. There might even be a diamond. But I believe that the way we use each of the todays of our life, and if we learn to do them right, we keep doing them better. We just keep doing them better. And our days and our lives get brighter and brighter, and the picture that we show to others becomes more and more attractive, and so others will want to be more and more like us. But I believe that that which adds the spotlight to any life is the spotlight of gratitude. To thank God for each today as it comes. I'd just like to make a few comments about this phenomenon of gratitude. I know that we talk it to death in AA. I remember one time I was at a meeting back in Baltimore, and a man got up and he said, I'm a grateful alcoholic. And I was sitting there almost, I really felt bad. I thought, Lord, I haven't even thought of gratitude in 3 weeks. And this is the way this man's introducing himself, as a grateful alcoholic. And then as I thought more and more about it, and as the years have gone by, my friends, we don't have to feel grateful. We have to be grateful. All right, just from my own background, you'll, I think, allow me this. You're all familiar with the story of the 10 lepers that Christ made clean. Like us alcoholics, they had to hide out in the hills because their friends, their neighbors, their relatives were ashamed of them. You see, they had a disease that was contagious. And they had to be pushed away. They were isolated from society. And if you remember the kind of heartrending way it was written, they cried out from afar, Son of David, have mercy on us. Do something for us. And he did. He made them clean. Now, no one in this room can convince me that all 10 of them did not feel something. I'm absolutely convinced they all felt grateful. It's impossible to have a disease in which parts of your body rot while you're alive to have something like that lifted from you and not feel grateful. The point was that only one acted on it, only one did something. I sometimes kind of cringe when I hear too much talk about how grateful I am in AA, because I'm sitting back there thinking the lady doth protest too much. You see, here's what I believe. If you are truly grateful, God, you won't have to tell me about it. I'll see it. Because real gratitude is step 12. It's called putting the money where the big mouth is. Don't tell me, show me. Somebody once said, I'd far rather see a sermon than hear one. And I'll never forget as long as I live, a young friend of mine by the name of Phil. I don't know how the subject came up, but he said, do you want to get disillusioned? I said, not particularly, but how? He said, put yourself on answering service on a weekend and try to get some of these grateful SOBs to take a 12-step call. He said, especially the ones that make you cry with how grateful they are, verbally. I believe that the honest-to-God beauty of gratitude, like any other virtue, can best be seen in the ugliness of its opposite. And ladies and gentlemen, everybody on earth despises an ingrate. Absolutely despises an ingrate. Even a little five-year-old kid. You know how you feel about a little kid that doesn't say thank you when you give him something? You just turn away. And you know it's somebody else's fault that the poor little kid's just forgetful, whatever. And have you ever heard this on, you know, Christmas is coming, right? And this wonderful grand slogan, it is far better to give than to receive. You bet it is, and it's a hell of a whole lot easier. You give me the fat wallet and let me throw the $10 bills out, but don't put me on the receiving end. It's a little bit tough. And sometimes I get, people have done wonderful things for me, and I've always tried, you know, when I'm capable of thinking of it, to thank them. And I have been met with this before, and see if you've ever said it. You know, you go up to somebody and say, you did something for me I couldn't possibly have done for myself. You gave me something I did not own and could not acquire. Thank you so much. And you're met with this aristocratic, don't thank me, thank God. Well, that's mighty big of you, but I don't believe you. If I do you a favor, thank me. Have you ever tried not thanking someone? Have you ever tried that? How often have we heard, it's crude, but it is said. Some bitch didn't even say thanks. Haven't you said that? I have. Ladies and gentlemen, if God Almighty demands it, how much bigger than God can I be to say it doesn't matter? Don't thank me. I really do cringe when people say that to me. Don't thank me. Well, I will. Even the prayer of an ingrate is an insult to the throne of God. The ingrate reaches as high as he can to get, instead of stooping as low as he can to give. You see, gratitude by its very essence comes from the soul of one who has received. And this is the greatest lesson that AA teaches all of us, that we depend completely on each other. Gratitude is the only coin with which you can buy God. You can buy sobriety by using this today to put the money where the mouth is and pass on to somebody else something of your sobriety. You have just paid for tomorrow's. You've just bought it. The loveliest definition of gratitude I ever heard in my entire life came from Austin Ripley's lips when he said, gratitude is the golden tray on which I offer to others what God has given to me. Gratitude is the hinge on which the sober life swings. And I believe that gratitude is the virtue that characterizes the life of Dr. Conway Hunter, whose 15th anniversary we're celebrating today. Anniversaries are wonderful things. It means an annual. The very word anniversary comes from the Latin word for year, so obviously it's a yearly thing, in which we add another candle to the brilliant light of the life of sobriety that illuminates the rest of us. He's one of the dearest friends I have on this earth, and though I call him by name, everything in me prefers to call him Dr. Conway, for that's what he is. A healer who walked right smack splat in the footsteps of a co-founder of AA who was a healer, Dr. Bob. From the very first time he ever had me down here over in that cafeteria do the old chalk talk there, I didn't know this man. I accepted the invitation to come down. I've known him ever since. I'm always stunned, believe me, that people of his caliber would consider using what I have for their programs. But I know this, that one day at a time, as he has lived this program of recovery, this meeting has grown to what it is. He said the first one, they had 15 people. You envision alcoholics going through the doors well and recovered and going their way to spread it. But it doesn't happen quite that rapidly. One day at a time, he did each thing that this day called for, and the progress happened. Last Monday, the 9th of November, we got our certificate of need in Maryland to go ahead with Ashley. We will finalize the sale after January 1, and we will begin the process of raising more money if we can for renovations. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been at that thing for 4 years, this month, 4 years. The frustration at times was unbearable. The expense at times was unbearable. But you keep at it a day at a time. You know, whenever you read your 24-hour book, read that little prologue right in the beginning of it. It says that each today, if it is well lived, will make each yesterday a dream of satisfaction and each tomorrow a vision of hope. And so they urge us to look well to this day. It's the most important one that God gave us. And so in each day, we could write down, verbalize to the good God gratitude for one's sobriety. That's one thing we can write down and do. And I think we will find the good things that are happening. But you know, it's an amazing thing about gratitude. We can never, never, never discharge our debts of gratitude. Supposing I could repay you for the good things that you have done for and given me. And suppose you could repay me for whatever I have done to you and our debts were discharged. There would be nothing to keep us together. Nothing. But each act of kindness that every human being performs just forges another golden link in the chain of gratitude that binds us together. May we never be able to repay each other the debts of gratitude we owe. I think that the ring that is worn on the hand is a kind of a perfect indication of this never-ending, no beginning, no end, this never-ending chain that binds us together. Now, I thought about that this week, and as you see, I wear a ring. Now, all my life, I never wore jewelry. It's all wristwatch. But this ring contains on it my family crest, and it was given to me by a fellow in La Jolla or Coronado, California, right near San Diego. He's Irish by birth. He is Scotch by nationality, and he runs an import shop where they do such things. And he had this made for me and gave it to me. And I wear it simply because of that, because every time I think of him, I offer a little prayer for his sobriety. He's been in AA since 1960, and just had his latest relapse about 3 months ago. So that's the only reason I wear this ring, but I'd just to let you in on some of my peculiarities. Wherever I go in the world, especially, you know, in places I've never been before, I always buy something of work, of real quality, of the area, so that I can remember it by. And I have a kind of a whole box full of rings, some of them very good. I never wear them. Every now and then I'll think of one, put on for 15 minutes. But I'll get back to that in a minute. I was down in Texas one time, and I was going to buy an attaché case, and a friend of mine said, let me get it. And he did. He paid for this attaché case. It's a very expensive thing. And I said, well, I was going to buy it anyway. I certainly didn't mean to prompt you to do this. He said, no, I want you to have it. He said, it's something from me. And I said, well, whenever I take it anywhere with me, it does mean something to me because it came from a friend. I could have bought it myself. I really could have. I had gone there for the express purpose of getting it. But it came from a friend. And I feel that way about this man. We have become very great friends over the years. And I told May yesterday, I said, May, I've only done this twice before in my life. But I want Dr. Conway to have something of mine that is personal. And if you would be kind enough to accept this, I'd like you to have. You really don't have to wear it, but you know it's from me. Thank you.